polar bears need sea ice to survive, but the Arctic is warming 10 times faster than other places in the world. That's an often repeated statement, but what does it mean for the future of polar bears, people, and other animals that live there? And how will those impacts affect the rest of the planet? Understanding global climate change through the lives of the Arctic's most iconic residents, the polar bear, is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and our guest today has built his career around studying the impacts of global warming and how it is endangering polar bears. He is clear in his stance that credible science points to warming. Welcome, Steve Amstrup.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Amstrup. I almost flubbed your name right at the beginning there. That's off to a flying start. Thanks so much for being in. It's great to have you back in Alaska, in the state. So I'm happy that you could come in and join us today. You also, Alaskans, can join our conversation. Do you think the decline in polar bears is a warning bell for other species in the Arctic? Sort of a Arctic canary in the coal mine? Does a warming Arctic signal chaos for other regions of the world? What can and should the U.S. and Alaska do in response to this change? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Dr. Amstrup, I want to take the discussion sort of in parts, starting with the Paris Accord, what it means. An accord is not a mandate. Countries who committed to reductions had to do so willingly. Does this work, do you think? Or should there have been more leverage built into this agreement?
Well, I think that the Paris Accords are a very important document, a very important process. It's complicated because they were not, the Paris Agreement was not a treaty, was not binding in any way. But as a part of that agreement and the discussions surrounding it, most of the nations of the world developed their nationally determined contributions to reducing emissions globally. And even though those weren't binding, they were things that many of the countries were already actually on a path to be able to make, and they just had to tighten their belts a little bit more to improve them. The fact that they weren't binding was largely a result of knowing that the U.S. Congress wouldn't ratify the agreement if it was put in the course of a treaty. So that's sort of the background on it. But I think that the prospect of us withdrawing from the agreement is really significant, partly because if you look at the total contribution that the U.S. has made to greenhouse gas concentrations, we are far and away the biggest contributor to the current concentrations and to the warming that those concentrations have caused and will be causing for the next several decades. So I think it's appropriate that as a nation, we take the lead in trying to get us out of that muddle that we have been a leader in putting ourselves into. The bottom line on the Paris agreements is that if we followed the nationally intended contributions, we would be heading towards end-of-century temperatures of about 3 degrees Celsius warmer than now. That's about 5.5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than we are now on average. That compares to 4 degrees Celsius or more warming that we would see on the historic business-as-usual path. But it's important to say that changes in economics, like conversion of power plants from coal to natural gas, and the major growth in wind and solar has already resulted in pushing us down towards the goals that we would have made by sticking to the Paris Agreement. And so the difference between what we might achieve by signing on to Paris and what we're actually on a path for at this moment is only about a half a degree. But with pulling out and with the other activities that the Trump administration is recommending, we could see ourselves going right back up to business as usual, which would put us on a 1 or 2 degree difference, 1 or 2 degrees warmer than what we might have been if we followed Paris. Now, who knows if that's really going to happen?
There was a report just today. Reuters put out an article about global energy demand has been sluggish over the last 3 years. The increase was 1%, and the fastest growing was renewables. So there is some offsetting happening, which I'm sure you appreciate, especially. As far as the Paris Climate Accord, the U.S. is out of it, yet some states and cities have said they'll commit despite the withdrawal by the federal government. Do you think that if states and cities make these commitments across the United States, can the country get there anyway? Or how important do you think it is that the federal government takes the lead on something like this that is a global effort?
Well, I think it's really important. And I want to finish up with the comment that I was about to make a moment ago, which was that the Paris Accords only committed the nations to approximately a 3 degree additional temperature rise by the end of the century. But all of the nations, and especially being led by the U.S. and China, in fact, the two biggest emitters right now, agreed that we need to do much, much better. So we need to add to our efforts agreed to in Paris to try and get ourselves down to 2 degrees. And that's where the national and international leadership really comes from. To your point, I think that cities, counties, states can do a lot to keep us from going too far out of line on this. But it really is unfortunate to not have the national leadership. And, you know, it's my hope that if indeed we are going to try and go as a nation on a different path, that the cities, counties, states, et cetera, will be able to drag our national leaders along in the right direction, kicking and screaming, because we really need to go a different direction than what this administration is suggesting.
If you are just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. My guest today is Stephen Amstrup. He is a polar bear scientist and has studied them for many, many years. We're discussing what happens in the future now that the U.S. has pulled out of the Paris Accord and what that may mean for the Arctic and the rest of the planet. Our numbers are 1-800-478-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions or concerns or comments about global climate change, about polar bears. Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to go to the phones quickly. Don is in Anchorage. Hi, Don.
Good morning, Lori. Steve. I discovered some time ago that Portage Glacier is not where it was when I came up here in 1968. In fact, it's pretty far back now. And to me, if you look at that map where Portage Glacier was at in 1948, and you look at it even in 68 when I came up here, and then you look at it now, it's pretty obvious global warming's going on. And, of course, Alaska is not the only state that has glaciers. Some people are not aware of that. California's got some. I think Montana has, Wyoming. And so it doesn't take an awful lot of wherewithal and looking for answers right under your nose to find out that it's there. I had a question come up here a while back that was very pointed regarding ocean depth and the pressures, which I was interested in because I used to do some scuba diving. And that was that as the glaciers melt and the waters rise, the downward pressure on the ocean floor drastically increases and also puts pressure on the geological plates, causing the earth to swell, and some of the areas that are losing glaciers to also have that ground rise, which exacerbates the situation, so to speak. Part of a theory, anyway, that was going around a while back. But I'd be interested in knowing how, what, if any, things that Steve has come up with as far as going beyond simple melting of water and changing the habitat. People can adjust. Animals can adjust. But as far as making things go haywire, we're notorious for that, and that should be curbed. And I'll get off and let somebody else have at it.
All right. Well, thanks, Don, for the call. I think what he's alluding to, we were discussing earlier about, you know, and I do want to get to why can't polar bears just figure out how to live on land? But before we do that, I want to go back to the Paris Agreement and talk through a few more questions in that respect. What's your level of concern, or what have you heard about the reaction of other countries since the United States has taken the U.S. out of the accord? Do you expect or think others will pull out or say, well, if the U.S. isn't going to do these things, why should we? Or, I mean, there seems to be kind of a mixed reaction right now. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I don't think that we're going to see other countries pulling out. In fact, the word that I hear is that we're going to see other countries redoubling their efforts, making sure that they hold to their commitments and do the best they can to meet it. And the unfortunate thing is that the U.S. ought to be a global leader here, and we're likely to become just a footnote. But I don't see the other country. This is too important, and it's too widely recognized as a problem. You know, we have benefited for millennia on Earth by having a climate that's stable because of stable levels of greenhouse gases, just the right magical amount that has allowed life on Earth. And if you agree with that, if you recognize that we're here, that all the animals that we care about are here, you have to also recognize that changing that balance of greenhouse gases is going to have an impact. If we say, well, you know, increasing levels of greenhouse gases are not the problem, then you have to come up with a whole nother theory for why we have life on Earth. So, you know, this is really significant. Everybody recognizes it around the world. I think this administration recognizes it. For some reason, they have chosen not to do anything about it. But I don't see other nations pulling out. And the other side of it is major corporations all around the world are jumping to the forefront saying, look, we have to stay in the Paris Agreement. We have to continue to do what we have started to do because this is really important. So I don't see other nations pulling out.
So in that vein, with other nations and large corporations saying we need to do these things, where then is this, the politics of denial coming from? Once upon a time, people thought the earth was flat, that you'd fall off. We know that's not true now. And even the most skeptical among us can agree that the planet isn't flat. But despite credible science, some of what you're just describing, skepticism is alive and stubborn across the nation and in the White House in this regard. A recent New York Times story highlighted Ohio teenagers who said climate change curriculum is brainwashing. Where do you think this springs from, and how important are these pockets of resistance in the larger conversation?
Well, there is a huge project, I don't know if you want to call it a project or a program, but an initiative to try and mislead the public about this. And I am not sure that I really understand it, but the only thing that I've been able to wrap my mind around is that there are a select few of very wealthy people who don't really care about the future, because they have done a calculation suggesting that I and my children will be okay for a while, and we can make a lot of money before the world becomes intolerable. And, you know, I can't imagine somebody really doing that, but I don't understand any other philosophy. And then those people are very influential and have developed a great following. Can't remember her name right now, but the author of the recent book, Dark Money, was asked in an interview recently, why are people doing the things that you've documented in your book? And she said, you know, I've asked as many questions as I can beating around that topic, and the only thing I can come to is that for these people, there is never enough money. Now, can I say that that's what's happening here? I don't know, but the science is so clear. You'd have probably heard the statistic that 97% of scientists agree with the that the world is warming and that humans are causing it. But it's actually even more than that, because if you look at the literature, 99.9% of the peer-reviewed literature takes that position, does not deny it. Now, some of those articles just take it as fact and then go on. So that's how you get down to the 97% that mm-hmm. if they don't explicitly mention it, but just assume it as part of their basis of operation, it's much more than that. So, you know, I think that it's so well understood why people would deny it is just beyond me.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. We have Doug in Talkeetna. Hi, Doug.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, but very interesting conversation this morning. I was calling just to sort of shed some light or regarding polar bears and up in the high Arctic in Svalbard. I work for an expedition cruise company that, you know, has been bringing visitors up there for over 30 years now. And myself, in just the 6 years I've been doing this and talking with colleagues that have been doing it for decades longer, it used to be in the 80s, people wouldn't bring visitors up to Svalbard to look for polar bears and experience the high Arctic until August, because the sea ice more or less encased the archipelago, making it, you know, not much fun to navigate. And now our ships are going up there in May. And because the sea ice is rapidly deteriorating by June and is mostly gone, you know, come July. And that, to me, seems like pretty in-your-face evidence. And so much so that while we're there visiting with people, we actually have the means to show people what's been going on, and then they learn, and they're usually people of means, and they kind of help spread the message, possibly to folks that might have formerly, denied, you know, climate change and anthropogenic climate change in particular. So, you know, to the extent that humans have caused the problem, you know, that's where you have a big confrontation with some folks, or at least a rich debate, when really, as you just mentioned, the science tells the story pretty clearly. So I was just wondering if you had any comments regarding that. And what you would see in the summertime, typically polar bears, the females with their cubs, will spend time near the archipelago because they're safer there. But the ice goes out so fast that then they no longer have anywhere to hunt, and they have to stick to the fast ice deep in the fjords that might have some seals there. And you see a lot of skinny bears stranded on land that normally would be out at sea. So pretty dramatic.
Well, thank you, Doug, for the call and those very clear and keen observations. It kind of goes hand in hand, and I want you to comment on this, Steve, with a question that we had from Brian Brettschneider in Anchorage, who wanted to know, with the polar bear habitat shrinking, as Doug was just describing in the Arctic, is there evidence that populations are encroaching on others' territory, and will bears intermingle or create different populations? So sort of in line with what Doug's observations were about, you know, bears and stress and skinny and less habitat, what's going to happen?
Yeah, well, to go to that question first, mm-hmm. and then I'd like to get back to Doug and Don's earlier question as well. We don't really know exactly what's going to happen with polar bears as their habitat continues to decline. We know that some places will probably relatively soon not be able to support polar bears. Well, where will those bears go? Some of them will just die. Some of them will probably move to other areas. But the farther north you go, or the farther into colder regions you go, those areas are already occupied by bears. So the extent to which they could absorb bears from other areas is not at all clear. We don't really expect that whole populations from one region that are displaced will end up being able to survive in another region that already is full of bears. That would be contrary to just about everything we know about wildlife populations. You know,
and them surviving on land is in great question as well, is it not? Because their bodies are sort of built for spending a lot of time in water and on ice. They have massive paws for swimming. And how would they fare if they had to become terrestrial?
Well, that's one of the main comments we often get is that, oh, you know, polar bears will just move onto land and start to act like grizzly bears. And there's two really important reasons why that can't happen. One is polar bears are the largest of all the bears. They're equivalent in size to Alaska brown bears. They have become really large by feeding on seals that they catch out on the fast ice. Out on the sea ice. That sea ice environment is a really rich environment for them because they've been able to catch those seals. They're kind of like giant fat pills laying out there on the surface of the ice. And that very rich food source has allowed the bears to become very large. If you contrast that to the terrestrial environment in the Arctic, that environment from the standpoint of a bear is very poor. And we have Mother Nature already having done an experiment for us on that. If you look at the grizzly bears that live adjacent to polar bears on land in northern Alaska and northwestern Canada, those are among the smallest of grizzly bears anywhere, and they occur at very low densities. Their reproductive rates are low. Why is that? Because there isn't very much food there. Why would we think that we could take whole populations of the largest bears in the world and dump them into a habitat that currently supports only small numbers of small bears?
So getting back to some of the other comments here, I'm sorry I kind of interjected there.
No, that's fine.
You wanted to get back.
Yeah, well, so we had Doug calling about the sea ice in Svalbard and Don calling about his comments on the glaciers. And I think that that's a good time to bring in the question of the impact of the kinds of temperature rises that we have seen and that we've expected to see. So we've seen a little bit less than a degree Celsius rise over the last century or so, global mean temperature. And what has that caused? Well, it's caused the declining of the glaciers. Pretty soon we're going to have to be calling it, used to be called Glacier National Park, because there won't be any glaciers there. The glaciers all over the world are declining, and most of them declining very rapidly. Ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland are declining. With a 1 degree Celsius rise, we've seen about two times the size of the state of Texas loss in summer sea ice. That's what Doug was talking about. The forest fire season in the western United States is 84 days longer now than it was just in the 1980s. Rising temperatures are impacting and will continue to impact human food supplies. So this is a huge impact that we've already seen with just a degree of average warming. What are we gonna have when we have 3 degrees of average warming? Global wheat production has been shown to decrease by 6% for every degree Celsius rise in temperature. And that's in the areas where the adaptation abilities are the greatest, like with the ability to maybe bring in supplemental water and things like that. And every day above 30 degrees, which is 86 degrees Fahrenheit, can result in a 6% decline in cereal grain productions if it occurs at the time of inflorescence or grain fill. It's been projected that we could have 49% loss or decline in cereal grain production just in the United States by the end of this century if we keep on our current path. What do we think that's going to do in places where agriculture is just sort of eking along already, like in Africa and the Middle East?
If you're just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing, well, a lot of things related to global climate change. Discussing the future of polar bears and also the broader impacts on the planet because of greenhouse gas emissions. Our guest is Dr. Stephen Amstrup. He is a longtime polar bear scientist and has spent a lot of time, most of his career, studying these massive beasts. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments or observations like we've been hearing this morning. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK, statewide. Or in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, as you've just been talking, the context related to temperature increases, it's overwhelming when you start looking at the percentages and what can happen. An article that you wrote in December references projections of 3 to 5 degree average temperature increases across Africa and the Middle East. And although you've been just describing that, I think that there could be folks that think, 3 to 5 degrees, that doesn't sound like a lot. And yet, what's happening then, based on that, is something that a lot of people can sort of wrap their heads around, which is this idea of refugees and the creation of climate refugees, not just people leaving countries because of war, but because of a lack of food, as you've been referencing. And that also can lead to war, as we know, if people have shortened food supplies. You've been studying bears, as we've said, for so many years. When were you last in the Arctic? And what in your tenure have you seen that you can really help people kind of wrap their heads around how quickly this is happening?
Well, I left Alaska in 2010, and I'd been here studying polar bears for 30 years. And during that time, I saw the Arctic totally transformed. From when I first went to Alaska, to the North Slope in 1980, in those early years, I could stand on the shoreline of northern Alaska in the summertime and see the sea ice. It was right there. Now, if you go up there, the sea ice is so far offshore you can't see it. It's beyond the curvature of the Earth. And like I said a moment ago, we've lost about 2.5 million square kilometers of summertime sea ice. And that occurred during that same 30-year period. So it's hard for me to imagine that if you'd have told me when I first came up here that I would see that kind of a transformation during my working career, I would have said you were crazy. But we're seeing the same thing in clear across the Arctic. And you said, when have I last been in the Arctic? I go up to the Arctic of Canada every year to Churchill, where polar bears aggregate on the shoreline waiting for the ice to freeze, and it freezes later every year. And last year, in fact, was an all-time record late freeze. That doesn't mean this year is going to be a record late freeze, but the tendency has been for the freeze to be delayed substantially over the course of the last several decades. And in fact, the ice-free period in that part of the world is about 30 days longer now than it was 30, 40 years ago. So, bears that come ashore, we were just talking about how there's very little food for them to eat. They're essentially food deprived. They're food deprived for a whole month longer than they used to be. In Alaska, it's a similar situation. The ice is now retreating in the summertime off of the valuable continental shelf and way into deep polar basin waters. The bears are forced ashore. In parts of Alaska, they come ashore and they feed on bone piles, the remains of whales that have been captured by local hunters. Mm-hmm. In most of the Arctic, they don't have that. And recent research has shown that when they're way offshore, they're also not finding much to eat.
We are talking about the future of polar bears and the future of the planet on Talk of Alaska today with Dr. Stephen Amstrup. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more calls and questions as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the future of polar bears and the future of the planet today with Dr. Stephen Amstrup. Our numbers statewide are 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We had an email question about coastal brown bears. This is from Rich in Sitka. Excuse me. He's saying that DNA evidence shows that Alaska coastal brown bears on the ABC Islands are related to polar bears. He says, possibly because of breeding between brown and polar bears. Does this indicate any possibilities for the future evolution of the bears? He says, from the comments I've heard so far, it sounds like not. But what is that possible, that they'll marry into grizzly bear families and figure it out? Or is that sort of kind of missing the point anyway?
Well, I think it's kind of missing the point. But it is thought that polar bears, well, it's known that polar bears and brown bears are very closely related, and that polar bears separated from a common ancestor with brown bears perhaps a million years ago, perhaps as recently as a quarter million years ago. There's a lot of uncertainty there. Molecular geneticists are rapidly trying to track this down, and every year there's a couple of new papers about how closely related they are and that sort of thing. But the ABC Island brown bears do appear to be the most closely related to polar bears. And in fact, it was a colleague of mine up here, Matt Cronin, and I published a paper about that years ago. That's been fairly well known. But I think the issue of hybrids has come up a lot recently, and it's come up because of the discovery of some hybrids living in northwestern Alaska. And what they found was a trophy hunter shot a bear, looked a little unusual. They did genetic testing. Oh, my God, it's a hybrid between a polar bear and a grizzly bear. There have been a few others, and in fact, now there's 8 known. And there's been this idea that, oh, my God, this is going to be the last straw for polar bears, is they're going to be bred out of existence. Or it's going to be the salvation of polar bears because they'll interbreed with grizzly bears and some of their genes will carry on, even if the ice disappears. And I don't think it's either of those cases. For one thing, there's been just a really nice new paper that just came out last week describing the hybrids in Canada, and it's actually one extended family group one female and her offspring, and two male grizzly bears that have bred with her. So one female polar bear. Most of those bears are dead now. They've been shot, I think they've been shot. But anyway, so it doesn't look like this was a widespread phenomenon. And importantly, what they haven't seen, and it doesn't mean it isn't out there, but they haven't seen those offspring that were hybrids breed back with polar bears. They've only seen them breed back with grizzly bears. So there may be some behavioral obstacle there that would prevent further interbreeding. But the genetic record, the molecular genetic record, suggests that over the million years or so that these animals may have been separated, that there have been episodes of hybridization. The key, though, as far as the future, breeding occurs in the spring. That's when we still have maximum sea ice. So it's not like all the bears are being forced ashore and, oh, well, while they're on shore, they're going to have sex with grizzly bears. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not what's happening. So we don't expect to see the breeding really be the limiting factor. And on the other side of the coin, you know, those who have suggested, well, polar bear genes will carry on in something that looks like a brown bear. Those of us who are concerned about polar bear conservation are concerned about the current life form. We don't really care that much about whether or not some polar bear genes are floating around in some future grizzly bears because their sea ice habitat has been lost.
You'd rather see polar bears as they are today continue
That's
on
right.
into the future.
That's right.
We had another email question that kind of gets back to when you were talking about this 30-year span and what you saw in 30 years and how it would have been difficult if someone would have told you you would see that. I know that you and I have talked about my coming to Alaska a little less than 20 years ago, and when I first came, hearing scientists say the Arctic could be ice-free in the summer in 100 years. Then in a very few years, the discussion was in 50 years. Now that window has shortened again, and some have argued that in the right conditions, we're pretty much there now, especially with new ice being much thinner than multi-year ice and weaker for resistance to storms and things like that, that parts of the Arctic are like a giant slushy. There's a question from James who says he wants to know about the ramifications of the thawing of permafrost and release of methane and how that can add both to the feedback loop and also acidification in the ocean. And I think the broader question for me is how much of that is captured in the modeling? Because as we've said, your observations over 30 years were stunning compared to anything you would have thought would happen in that time. I've heard the same conversation, how quickly this window has shrunk from 100 years to pretty much any time now. And with this added concern, methane release from permafrost, is that accurately being built into the systems that reveal the feedback?
Scientists are grappling with it. It's a really good point because in 2010, my colleagues and I published a paper showing for the first time that there's a linear relationship between global mean temperature and sea ice extent. So as temperatures go up, sea ice extent goes down. It's a linear but inverse relationship. That's subsequently been verified by a number of other researchers. But that relationship only looks at temperature and sea ice. It doesn't look at other things that might control the temperature. And as we gradually warm, and this gets to one of the dangers of proceeding along the path that we have been on of just allowing the world to continue to warm, we risk overcoming or exceeding some thresholds that we may not be so easily to recover from. And one of them is the release of methane and other forms of carbon from cold soils, methane clathrates in the seafloor. There are a lot of trapped greenhouse gases that if we hit a certain threshold temperature, they might just come burping out at an enormous rate and make it very difficult to recover. So that's a reason for us to act quickly. The extent to which those are being captured in the models, I can't say that I'm really very familiar with that, but I know scientists are working on it.
All right, let's go back to the phones again. Duke is in Fairbanks. Hi, Duke.
Hi there.
Question?
Hey, I do biology work around the state and some part-time guiding in Denali, so I have some science exposure, and then I have these moments where I'm sort of interpreting that and talking with people that are maybe out with me on hikes. Steve, you'd mentioned how, you know, one explanation to sort of the short-sightedness, excuse me, is just looking at, you know, how much money am I going to make for myself and just my kids, like one or two generations ahead. It seems like that economic argument is really important, especially when people are saying, oh, you climate people, you know, it's become a religion. You're just on one about it. So any like resources or further ways to learn about talking about how it's going to hit people in the wallet, I think is a good way to help them wake up about the, you know, facts and reality of it. And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Duke.
Well, and certainly most of us are not in the position where we will benefit in any way from a continually warming world. There may be some of the very rich out there who could, but I certainly am not, and I suspect you are not. So this is, you know, it looks to be another sort of exclamation point on the widening of income disparity across the world.
Mm. Let's stick with the phones for a moment. Jimmy is in Kotzebue. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi. I heard you guys talking about the polar bears. Obviously, we had some polar bears come into Kotzebue, and that's very rare. Last year, they had to warn some people over here in Kotzebue. We went, we live off the land, geez, and we went out there several days ago, last week sometime. As soon as the ice leaves our town and the lake a little bit, we usually find Ugruk right not too far from where we're at. So this last time, I went hunting, say, 30 years ago. We found some just not too far, say, and then now we have to go way far out there. The ice is really, this last part of the ice that left our lakes, the Kobuk Lake, whatnot, up, the last part of it, I noticed it's really melted fast. It's so thin. We have, back in the day when I was a young kid, we used to have freeze up in September. And in 40 years, I've seen a lot of changes. Like, now we have to wait till November sometime, maybe October, late October. So I'm really concerned about our lifestyle now. It's really changing. So that's all I have to say. And we had a president come up here, Obama, and the first time I seen him, he gave the borough or whatever, our region, $1 million to help us with erosion control. So thank you for your time and have a good day.
Thank you, Jimmy, for your real life observations. I mean, that there's another scientific observation of someone's lifetime and seeing those changes in real time and talking about how that's impact their way of life, not just seeing a difference in what's happening, but also the impacts to their way of life. Some of the graphs that you've used, Dr. Amstrup, and we've linked on our website for those who want to delve more deeply into the science, you can go to alaskapublic.org and look at a lot of the images and graphs that Stephen Amstrup has brought with today. Some of them show temperature comparisons of RCP 8.5 and RCP 2.6. Describe for us what this is. Break that down for us and tell help the average layperson understand what this is.
We started out by talking about the Paris Agreement and the fact that the goal of the Paris Agreement was to try and hold the Earth's temperature rise to about 2 degrees or less Celsius. Climate modelers didn't have the benefit of what was talked about in Paris just last year. And so prior to that, they had developed a series of scenarios that they thought, well, the world could take, and the world and its economies could take this path or this path or this path. And the most recent version of those scenarios are called Representative Concentration Pathways, or RCPs. And the RCP 8.5 is the one that we have kind of historically been on up until very recently. It's basically business as usual, not being concerned about greenhouse gas emissions. The RCP 2.6 very closely approximates what was talked about in Paris. And so that's why I put that there. That basically, if we were to follow the RCP 2.6 plan, we would stabilize the Earth's temperature at around an additional warming of around 2 degrees by the end of this century, and it would stabilize beyond that. So the world would be warmer than it is now, but it would be a lot less warm than it would be under business as usual. So modelers have used those as kind of major contrasts of where we could be going if we just start mining coal again and burning as much oil as we can and not being cognizant of future generations, or if we are more cautious, use our fossil fuels more wisely. And I want to emphasize, I think we're going to be dependent in many ways on fossil fuels for a long, long time, but we need to use them more wisely. And so those are the contrasts there. And I think that the important thing to note is that if you look at the temperature curves, if you look at the contrast between those two, is that following business as usual results at the end of the century in a world that we will not recognize, a world that's as warm as it's been, warmer than it's been for the last 3.5 or 4 million years, one that is simply not at all like the world that has allowed humans or the other life forms we know about to flourish. Whereas the 2.6, or the Paris Agreement, gives us a world that at least the temperature regime will overlap that with which we're familiar. It'll be warmer, things will be different, but at least it will be recognizable.
Before we take a quick break, I want to get one last question in, and then when we come back from the break, let's move on to what people can do and try to end on a little more of an optimistic note. We discussed the other day about even if tomorrow we could somehow shunt back the flow of fossil fuel impacts of, as you said, we are going to be using and needing fossil fuels and all that derives from them for quite some time before we can make a wholesale change to complete renewable clean energy. But if we were to get to the 2.6 tomorrow by some magic effort, there's still inertia in the system that's already there. What does that mean? What will that spell for us into the future, even if we were to achieve the Paris Accord in a year from now?
Well, this is part of what I think is the really good news. And there is good news here. I mean, we're learning as we go, of course. We didn't start out burning fossil fuels with the intent of warming the world. We started out burning fossil fuels to benefit and improve our lives. And we've done so. Now we recognize that there's a side effect that we need to deal with. And we can deal with it. And recent research has shown that if we were to stop the growth in greenhouse gas concentrations, that within 10 years or so, we would see the peak of heat resulting from that. So that's within our lifetimes. That's not something that if we act now, only our great-great-grandchildren are going to see. We will see it. And so I think that's a really important outcome. And the work that we did in 2010, looking at the relationship between temperature and sea ice extent, showed that sea ice, the home for polar bears, would actually stabilize within about 25 years of when we stabilized greenhouse gas concentrations. So, these kinds of, there are carryover effects. Like you say, there's that global inertia, but the inertia isn't so strong that it's beyond our ability to recognize. We can benefit from that, from those actions now. It's not just about the future.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll take a couple more calls and more questions as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Their online, evening, and campus-based courses make education accessible and will fit into any busy schedule. Be motivated by a devoted faculty and creative, independent-minded students. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. Moving life ahead with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go back to the phones quickly in our final moments here. Steve is in Homer. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Did you have a question? Good morning.
Well, yeah. I was very fortunate to study the politics of global warming back before the meme makers, destroyed credibility of scientists and they questioned to the 99% of those that believe this is happening. And I believe the cause is lost. And what the question I have is what to do in the next 20 years, knowing that the present coastlines will change radically, and Florida will be completely underwater, and probably 3 billion people will be displaced. And if we start planning now, we might be able to not have global catastrophe is what we're really heading for, because I don't think the greedy people that control this planet are going to back off the use of fossil fuels. So I'll take my answer offline.
Wow. Thanks for the bummer, Steve.
We were supposed to end on a happy note.
We were going to try to come up a little bit here, and Steve just brought us right back down.
Well, it is easy to be in that sort of depressed position, because sometimes it just seems to be incredibly daunting.
It is overwhelming.
And and we've got this tremendous separation in our society, where if you're a conservative, you don't believe in global warming, even if it isn't really about belief. And if you're a liberal, you have to endorse it. And you're not going to talk with the other side. And I think that that's really unfortunate. I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to battle like crazy on the floor of the House about legislation. And then in the evening, they drink whiskey and smoke cigars together. And they would solve the world's problems. We need to get back to that. But regardless of that, we can still save this. And I think it's really important to not give up hope. And what's some of the evidence of that? Well, the evidence, I started talking earlier in this show about how nations had actually been making substantial progress already just because of economic forces. We can continue to build on those. And, the president has withdrawn us from the Paris Agreement, but more than 100 major companies have written letters pushing for us to stay in and have maintained that they want to continue to recognize the threat and to do something about it. And these are major companies, including ExxonMobil, Cargill, Dow Chemical, Cummins Diesel, companies that you might not expect would really want to jump on the line on this, but they recognize the threat. And, there are things that we can do. And I think the other major encouraging thing, people always want to know, well, what can I do? There are a lot of sort of conservation things you can do around the house. And we've already, I'm sure everybody's heard about, well, turn the lights off when you leave the room, turn the thermostat down, all of those things, the relatively low-hanging fruit. What we really need to do is have a fair price on carbon. We have to have a carbon tax. There are policies out there that will allow us to incentivize the and equalize the playing field, level the playing field for renewable energy sources compared to non-renewable energy sources. And we need to get there. And one of the really exciting things is that there's some really strong conservative politicians out there who are leading the charge on this. Former Secretaries of State James Baker and George Shultz, and former Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson, who also, by the way, was the CEO of Alcoa. And these people are working strongly to encourage our government to establish a carbon tax. And it would be a tax that would include a refund, a rebate back to the consumers, so that it wouldn't be, it wouldn't hit you and me in the pocketbooks really deep, but it would be the, it would provide the incentive to make sure that we aren't continuing to give the subsidies to the carbon-based fuels. And really, what it amounts to is a subsidy, because you burn, say you burn a ton of coal, you contribute 3.5 tons of CO2 to the atmosphere, and you don't pay a tax on that. Our future generations, our children and grandchildren, will be paying that tax one way or another. But this program would make that payment come up front along with it. And we all know that when you tax something, you do it less.
So that's sort of at the 50,000 foot level. And as you just alluded to, it's not as simple as a conservative versus liberal argument. There are people on both sides of the political spectrum who have belief and certainty about what needs to happen in the future. Coming down to our level here, just as individuals, I know that you live off the grid, and that might not be possible for everyone to do that. But beyond just turning off the lights and lowering the thermostat, what else can people do to feel like they aren't helpless and just being pulled along in this massive direction that the planet's heading in? What can they do?
Well, I think the basic thing is to pay attention to your energy use. So whatever it is, whether it's how many trips to town you have to make for shopping, consolidate them, minimize it. Can you do one grocery shopping trip a week instead of one every day? Can you walk or ride your bike? In some parts of the world, not so much in Alaska, mass transit is a real option. And if you ever spent any time in Seattle, and you know that they now have that light rail system from Tacoma up to the University District, it's packed all the time. Those people would have been driving or taking some other source of energy. And so those sorts of things, just thinking about, okay, this requires energy, how can I minimize it? And then looking at that big picture of pushing for our leaders to do what needs to be done.
All right. Thank you so much. Dr. Stephen Amstrup has been our guest on Talk of Alaska today, talking about polar bears and the future of the planet and what we can all do to help the effort of reducing greenhouse gas emissions as we move into the future. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. This has been Talk of Alaska. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.